Good morning, GPN. Today we have Matthias here. He's an open source enthusiast, and he will give us a deep dive into TensorFlow.js and how to build neural networks in JavaScript.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so first of all, anyone not speaking German here? Okay, do you want me to hold the presentation in German or English? Yeah, okay, in English. So, well, currently my background is that I'm really working full-time in a project for defect detection in the aviation industry, but personally I like computer gaming a lot, and there's nothing more fun except for writing your own computer games in the browser, and I also wanted to make a little gesture recognition model to play a game. So we do it with JavaScript. Okay, so first of all, I would think I'll give you a short introduction to neural networks. Does everyone know about neural networks in theory? Who does know about neural networks in theory? Okay, so we'll shorten this part. Then we'll talk a bit about use cases, especially in the JavaScript world. I'll introduce you to TensorFlow and TensorFlow.js. Then we'll train a little classifier and use that classifier in a browser game. And then, if we've got the time, I can talk a bit about recent ideas of efficient neural networks. Okay, so short introduction is that there's a thing called universal approximation theory, which states that you can nearly approximate any function, any continuous function, in a compact subspace. So this is really powerful, and there's a visual explanation behind it. If you take, for example, the sigmoid function, which is kind of S-shaped, if you parameterize it correctly, you can make it very steep so that it's nearly a step function. And if you change the parameters W and B accordingly, you can also get the step function to activate at any given point X, denoted as S. This is where the step activates. So if you now activate a step at a certain point X, and you just subtract it again later on, you get a little bump out of it. And if you are weighing the output also, you can adjust the height. When you've got this, you just need to sum it up. And here we can see that you can model a continuous function using linear segments in this example. And it also works for other activation functions as well. Okay, about convolutional neural networks. Convolutional neural networks build on the concept of filters. So you might already be familiar with Lena from OpenCV. And there's an example where you do a Sopel operator to get the edges. So filters can basically get edges or analyze textures. That means analyzing frequency content. It's like an FFT. Okay, so a filter has a very limited field of view. It has got local connectivity, and we convolve it around the input image. So we've got filters and weights, and we just need to do element-wise multiplication and sum everything up and get our output. Okay, so how do edges work in reality? When you've got an edge, you've got a change in pixel intensity from, let's say, light to dark color, for example. And you cannot see this very well on the left side, but if you take the first derivative, you've got such a hill-shaped form where you can just threshold it. And so you can say, above the threshold, I'm going to find an edge. Okay, and this is classically done using the Sobel operator. There, the weights are set manually so that you get a discrete differentiation operation out of it. Then you combine a filter for the horizontal and the vertical edges, and get an edge detector. Okay, but in convolutional neural networks, you will learn the weights, so you don't need to set them manually. And when you stack multiple convolutions on top of each other, you can aggregate features. Like in the first few layers of the neural network, you can learn things like edges, some basic textures, and you can aggregate them, and in the middle here, you can already see some things like eyes, and on the right, you can even see a little bird in there in the feature maps. Okay, so how do we learn those weights? First of all, we need to specify a loss function, which we're going to minimize. And then it's very difficult because we've got such a high dimensional space. So normally a convex problem would be easy to solve because you just get into the optimum. But in high dimensional space, it's very difficult to get it like this. There are a lot of local minima, and the method you're using currently is gradient descent with a lot of modifications for better results. So here you see a little visualization of a convex problem, which is easy to solve because you get to the global optimum. And on the right side, you already see two optima. So how can you get out of a local optimum? You can get out by applying a learning rate schedule. So when you're doing your gradient descent updates, you want to get them to be lower and lower to converge into a minimum. But then you raise it again to propel out of this optimum, of this maybe local optimum, and get into another optimum, which is probably better. And then you want to converge again. OK, so how does it look? Looks like this. You travel around the high dimensional space, get into your optimum. And because there are so many of them, you could also employ averaging techniques, ensemble techniques, like when you've got a lot of local minima, which are good, you can store them. And later on, you will average the weights of the neural network, and it will be more robust. OK, so where do we use neural networks? In general, we can use it for nearly anything we can approximate. So we could try to learn fraud detection, time series forecasting, maybe the weather or stock prices, do document analysis, or retrieval tasks. Retrieval means, for example, you paint a sketch of, let's say, a cat, and you get all the cat images out of your asset database, if you're a creative designer, for example. And then, of course, there's text-to-speech, speech-to-text, and translation. And recently, Microsoft published a paper where they say that they are on par with human word error rate when transcribing Chinese to English, for example. So this is really crazy. And natural language processing is really on the rise since end of last year with models like ULMFit, ELMO, and BERT nowadays. OK, but to be a bit more JS-specific, you've got a lot of advantages when you run your model in the browser. So you can, for example, save bandwidth because you can pre-encode features, let's say from a video stream, and send a representation that does not take as much bandwidth and send it over to the server. Or you can get GDPR compliant because you don't even transmit data to a server and you evaluate everything locally. And there are, of course, alternative control methods, which we're going to use today in a computer game, like gesture recognition. And we can build game AIs in general. So our showcase will be a simple game that resembles a bit the Raptor game from the 1990s. Perhaps some of you know it already, the game. And we want to build a simple classifier in this case. We're just going left and right. OK, so we need to know a bit about TensorFlow.js. So TensorFlow generally has a long history. And the essence is that Google used the tool internally and then published it. And it was written in Python and has got some C++ and CUDA code to get hardware acceleration. Then they announced the tensor processing units. And TensorFlow already came with support for them. And tensor processing units are really specialized because they hardwire some activation functions and get really great speedups out of it. Then they also published things like TensorFlow Lite, so you can get your models running on Android, for example, when you're writing Java. They published Collaboratory, which is kind of a Jupyter notebook. It's like a wiki where you have code and can execute it. And it runs in the cloud, and you can already make use of TPUs, for example, so you can get around 140 teraflops for free. As a comparison, your laptop has probably 140 or 60 gigaflops. OK, and then TensorFlow.js recently came along was initially developed, and they also published visualization things for it. And nowadays we can say that TensorFlow.js can be used in production because they published the first stable release. Okay, so we can run it nearly everywhere, in nearly every environment. Okay, about the concepts. A tensor is just a multidimensional array, nothing more. And it's immutable. So if you run an operation, you get a new tensor out of it, and you still have the old tensor. So in TensorFlow.js, you really need to do memory cleaning yourself, because otherwise you could end up with a lot of tensors on your GPU or just in memory, which doesn't get cleaned up, and then you're getting out of memory. Okay. Furthermore, there are variables. Variables can be mutated and are important if you want to do things differently, let's say, for example, during training or test for techniques like dropout, for example. And then there's the model abstraction, which just takes inputs, transforms it somehow, and produces an output. OK. After all that, we've got the optimizer, which does gradient descent and fits our model between the input data and the desired outcome. And TensorFlow.js really follows the Keras specification. So for those of you programming a lot in Python, you may have used Keras already because it's easier than the plain TensorFlow API and it's shorter to write. And TensorFlow.js adapted this API specification from the beginning. So it's very easy to write code. And if you're running in the browser, you get hardware acceleration by using WebGL and the shaders. Because when you want to write games, for example, you need those shaders to calculate like things like lighting or something like this. And this already operates on large matrices and does the same operation on a lot of data. So this is great for us. And TensorFlow.js already abstracts us away from this. So if you're running it on Node.js, for example, you will use the CPU or maybe the GPU if you've got an NVIDIA device. But when running in the browser, you really get the hardware acceleration no matter what kind of graphics cards you have, because you're using WebGL and not some Windows-specific things like CUDA. OK, so basic development workflow is just building the model, fitting it between input and output data, and run your predictions. And it is really that easy. Here we see an example. On the left side, we see JavaScript code. And on the right side, we see the Python Keras code. So if you've already programmed in Python with Keras, you won't notice any difference, basically. So what are we doing here? First of all, we're building our model, and we say it's a sequential one. That means we just stack layers on top of each other. If we want some more expressiveness, we should use the functional API, because in a functional API, we could also take two different results and put it in another function, which allows us for more advanced architectures. So then we add the layers to our model. This is just a simple fully connected layer here. And then we need to build the model, which is done using the compile function. Here we specify the optimizer, like stochastic gradient descent or Adam. I would suggest you use Adam because it's already best effort and does a great job generally. You don't need to set any hyperparameters or things like that. And you need to specify your loss function. If you want to do regression, you could, for example, use mean squared error. If you want to do binary classification, you use cross entropy, for example. And then we're just allocating our data. Here, the only thing that differs from Python is that you need to set the shape. And then we fit the model, specifying the inputs and the desired outputs. And we tell the model how many epochs to run. And an epoch is just seeing all the data once. OK, because we cannot put all the data into memory, we use little batches. And when we've seen all the batches, you say you've visited an epoch. OK, and then we run the prediction using the predict method. So nothing so special in it. How do we build our classifier for the game? First of all, to make training quicker, we use a pre-trained model from a domain that can be adapted to ours. And then we build our own classifier on top of it. So in this case, we're taking the MobileNet architecture because it's really parameter efficient. It uses few parameters and fewer calculations than other models. As a comparison, in 2014, the VGT16 model had around 140 million parameters, and such a mobile net may have 2 million parameters for doing segmentation tasks, for example. Okay, so we're saving a lot of computational power here. Okay, but the mobile net was trained on ImageNet, which does classification. And we don't want to use classification of things like pizza and cars and other stuff, but we want to do our own classification. So we truncate the model at a certain point and put our own classification head on top. And for our little game, we will just want to have three actions, going left, going right, and doing nothing. So we could, for example, flatten this three-dimensional volume here and build some fully connected layers on top of it, and we get three probabilities out of it. So we can just softmax it because they are mutually exclusive, and probabilities can never go above one, right? If you're not having mutual exclusivity, you could just sigmoid everything in here and don't apply the softmax over everything. Okay, but maybe you can already see a little design issue here. So what do you think? How many parameters do we have in the mobile net, and how many parameters do we have approximately in the classifier? Are they on par or equal size? Is one bigger than the other? Yeah? Okay, a little hint. We've seen the filters, and filters use very few weights. But fully connected layers really have a weight for connecting every neuron to another neuron. So in here, we've got 50k values coming from this 7 × 7 × 1000. And when we have a layer that goes from 50k values to like 100 values, we've got a weight matrix of 50k times 100. So this is already a lot. And so the classifier would take up just as much memory as the mobile net does. So of course, we can improve this. For example, we could do global average pooling, which makes those 7 × 7 dimensions 1 × 1. This reduces the model a lot, but we lose the spatial dimension, and the spatial dimension is especially important for our task because we want to go left, right, or do nothing. So global average pooling is really the way to go if you want to do classification, and MobileNet does this for its classification task. But we could also decrease the depth of the output of the network here, because we don't need 1024 feature maps to separate a lot of different object classes. We essentially only need one, because we want to detect persons. So we can do a 1 × 1 convolution on top of it and reduce it to one to a depth of one and save a lot of memory. So this would make the model a lot smaller. So in comparison, this model has around 20 megabytes, and you would get it to 24 kilobytes. Okay, so now we want to try a little live training to demonstrate you the effectiveness of transfer learning, because normally you always think that you need a lot of data to train neural networks, but this is not always the case. So I want to train the action of going left, going right, and doing nothing. And I just capture two instances per class, train the network, and it was really fast. And then I can classify, and we will see the class on the right side. So let's try going left, having a class of 0, having a class of 1 here, and in the middle, we've got a class of 2. So that's it. Took about 3 seconds, and we already got a usable model. OK, so let's look into the code, because you're all here because you want to know how to do it yourself. First of all, we need to capture the images from webcam. And therefore, we use the media devices API and query a get user media. And we specify some constraints. So our pre-trained model needs an input size of 224 times 224. That's why we specify that we want to have exactly this dimension of images in the video stream. So when the video stream is loaded, we get a loaded data event. That means the first buffer, the first image, is available for us. And then we can resolve a promise because we might want to wait until video is initialized, and when the promise is resolved, we know that we can continue. And it's done asynchronously in general. Okay, so when we capture a video frame, we can already use a TensorFlow function, tfrompixels. We connected our video stream to an HTML video element previously, and now we can just say, take this video element, which you can get by document get element by ID, for example, and you want to get a single frame out of it. Now, the pre-trained mobile net already used some pre-processing when training the model. So what they did is shifting the values between minus 1 and plus 1. They've normalized it. So we also need to normalize our data to have the same conditions in the input data as they used for the pre-training. Okay, so we first of all expand the dimensions because we need to have some batch access in front, not just a single image, but we get a batch of size 1, convert it to float, divide it by 127, and subtract the 1. Okay, so how do we gather data into some collection? In here, we've got a little collection capturing the actions, the three actions. And we want to add an instance to it to use it for training later. So when we add an instance, we first of all want to convert the label, because the label could be 0, 1, or 2, and we want to get three probabilities out of it. So we use the so-called one-hot encoding, which converts this class label to our desired number of probabilities. And you can already notice that we're cleaning up memory here with tftidy. Everything you do in a tftidy block will be cleaned away, except for the tensor that you return, because you want to work on it. OK, and then for the first time, we can just say our axes are just the single image we got, and we also add our first label. And then when we go on, we need to add to a collection, and when we add to a tensor, we cannot mutate it because they're immutable. So we need to concatenate our existing tensor, add the new instance to it, and we want to keep the result of that. And we also want to dispose the old tensor, which contains our smaller array, because we've just added to it. And in here, you also see the memory cleanup with the dispose function. OK, so how do we train our backbone model? How do we train our mobile net? TensorFlow allows us to store models in the browser using IndexedDB, for example, which is great, because you can store blobs in there. And we will make use of this by using a URL scheme that prefixes the location with IndexedDB. So what do we do? We first of all want to set a certain location where we want to cut the model. In the model, there are names of convolutional layers, activation functions, and we use such a named function to cut it later. So first of all, we load the mobile net using this function here. And first of all, we try to get it locally from IndexedDB. If it doesn't work, we just load it here from our server or from Google or from anywhere, and then save it to the IndexedDB for later use. So now we can use it offline. OK, so how do we now cut the model at a certain point? We could just cut it by using the TF model, and we say that we're using the original inputs of the mobile net, but we don't want to use the original outputs of the mobile net, but we want to get a layer, a certain layer, this conf13 PB ReLU layer, and take its outputs and specify it as our model's outputs. So we've essentially sliced the model. Okay. And when you have trained the model, you could also want to predict things, because you want to know when you've got an image, if you want to go left, right, or do nothing. And then you also load the model and just use the predict function on it. OK, now let's build our classification head, which is customized and built on top of the truncated model. So first of all, we need to specify the backbone, our mobile net, because we need to work on the results we get out of that model. Okay, so how do we build our head? First of all, there are choices. You could do the fully connected model, which is very large, but takes very few training instances. Or we could just flatten, no, sorry. So we could use the flattened model with the fully connected, which is big. But we could also employ our little trick with a convolution of size 1 times 1 to get a single filter out of it to reduce the 7 times 7 times 1024 dimensions to just a single dimension. And we will employ this technique and add some more layers to our network. We flatten the data now and convert it to the desired number of classes in a dense layer to get our 3 probabilities out. And then we say we want to build this as a sequential model and can then use it. When we run a prediction, actually, we use the backbone model to predict an input image. We get this intermediate output out of it and run it through our own model and get the results, our desired probabilities. Classification is just the same thing, but we want to get a class out of it. So we run the prediction and convert our result to a one-dimensional vector containing 3 probabilities. And then we're taking the index with the highest probability, because this will be our class. OK. And for training, there's also not so much code involved. You just instantiate the Atom optimizer for doing the gradient descent for you. You can specify a learning rate, but it has sensible defaults also. And load your model, compile it as seen previously, and then fit it between your data set inputs and labels, which is what you have seen in the little GUI. OK. So now when you want to use the model, you want to initialize capturing from webcam again to use it in our simple game, for example. We init the video, wait for it to be initialized, and then load our saved model, which can be stored by model save, by the way. We load it, truncate it again, and load our classification head, and that's it. So now we've got the webcam initialized, models loaded, and we can get a single image from the webcam, run it through the encoder, then run the intermediate result through our classifier and get the data back by calling datasync and get our classification label back. And if it's 0, we just move left. If it's 1, we move right. And if it's the other class, we just stop moving in our game. And then we also call await TF next frame, because we don't want to waste CPU cycles. So when your model is really fast, you would just have an endless loop in here, which is a bad thing. And tfnextframe just waits for the next animation frame, so it caps execution to 60 frames per second in the browser. And then we can just use this function because it runs asynchronously and does not block us forever. OK, so how does it work? We can see this game right now with better graphics. And lighting conditions are a bit bad in here because normally it just changes weapons. But you can see that position really works. So this is doing regression here. In fact, it's really running a postnet on the input images. So it's a bit more sophisticated, the model. So it tracks my eyes, nose, if it cannot find the eyes, and uses it to steal the game. OK. So let's talk a bit about efficient models, because you have seen that the game really runs fluidly in the browser. It runs around 50 frames per second, which is amazing, I think, because in the past, models were quite slow. And models that do segmentation or even pose estimation were even slower. And nowadays, we've got very efficient ones. So the model families I would suggest to use these days are dense nets and mobile nets, because they're really optimized for fast processing. When using the mobile net, you already get a lot for free from Google. For example, you get a mobile net with an SSD Lite object detector. So you get rectangles out of it and object classes, if you want that. If you want to do segmentation, that is producing masks of, let's say, people, for example, you can use MobileNet along with DeepLab, which is already trained by Google, and you can just use it in your application. And there's, of course, also PostNet, and they also provide you with an implementation, which is doing a bottom-up approach, because there are essentially two approaches. One of the approaches is to run a two-stage predictor, which gives you region proposals, like here could be, in here, in this rectangle, could be a person, and then do further processing on this data. Or you could use a bottom-up approach, where you just go over the entire image and get back, for example, a heat map. And this heat map is used to, let's say, predict key points like the elbow joints or your wrist. Okay. Another idea are bottlenecks. Bottleneck structures reduce depth in a three-dimensional volume. So the input dimensions won't get reduced, but the depth is getting smaller, and it does not have that many parameters, and so you save a lot of computational power. Okay, another idea are shortcut connections, because when your model is getting very, very deep, you've got a problem with the gradient descent optimization. Neural networks are basically stacking functions onto each other, and when you've got nested functions, you need to apply the Leibniz chain rule when differentiating. So let's take the example of a sigmoid function. It saturates on both ends, so the signal gets around zero. When you multiply it, you cannot propagate it further. So one thing to ease this is to apply shortcut connections so that you get quicker feedback from the output to layers that are nearer the input. And another technique is batch normalization, or using an activation function like the SELU, which has got a little exponential component and a linear one, and is parameterized so that the values will be shifted into a range that gets close to zero mean and also standardizes the value a bit. So there's a proof of convergence. I think it's 170 pages, the papers from Sepp Hochreiter. Okay, this is done in the ResNet, for example, by applying an identity function in here and adding it to the result of a layer. So the main idea is residual learning. That means when we don't need to learn anything anymore in this layer, the weights are essentially zero, and we just take the identity shortcuts. And if not, there's only a small difference between the desired inputs, probably, and what we want to get. So we only learn the difference between the identity function and what we need to adjust in here. Another paper that's very interesting is the DenseNet paper. They don't do it using addition, but they concatenate feature maps. And with this concatenation of feature maps, you get a feedback even of the output right back to the input. So signal propagation when using a backprop is really great. And they the design allows us to reuse features. So when you think of a neural network like a computer program, you might want to calculate something and use it in different places later. So this design enables us to do that. And so we can make smaller models. In the DenseNet, for example, you don't grow your models from like 32 filters to 64. You just add a constant amount of new filters. So the idea is that you can reuse existing information and add a bit of new information to it. Okay, and then there are non-standard convolution. A normal convolution has a lot of parameters. So when you want to get from input depth m to output depth n, you have such a volume of filter size times m times n. And if we do a little example and use an input depth of 16, output depth of 32, and a filter of size 3 times 3, we already get 4,600 parameters out of it. But if we separate the operation into two distinct operations, first doing a spatial convolution, and then doing a depth-wise point-wise convolution, we can reduce the number of parameters and the number of calculations involved. So if we do the maths, here we've got 16 times 1, because the depth of the filter is 1, times 3 times 3, which is 144 parameters in the depth-wise part. That's not very much. And then we've got the point-wise convolution stacked on top of it, and we get another 500 parameters, and the total sum is 650 parameters, and this is only 7% of the number of parameters of the standard convolution. So it's a factor of 14 improvement already, also in number of calculations. So to sum it up, to see the improvement again, in 2014, we had models which were really, really big, and now they're getting smaller and smaller and very efficient to compute on mobile devices. So it's a great time to use computer vision on your mobile device, in your browser, wherever you want. And that's my key message here. So, thank you. Do we have any questions? Yes, please.
One second.
Do you have your code on GitHub or something like that?
I can publish it to GitHub and please send a link to the organizers, maybe. Yes.
Yeah, just use pre-talks for that.
Okay.
There you can, I think, comment your own talk, and there you could publish the link.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Okay, I don't see any questions. Then thank you very much for your presentation and your deep dive into TensorFlow.js. And for all of you, have a nice day at GPN.
Okay.